The other, the romantic figure of Chopin, the Polish hero, now towers like a titan over the diminutive, much-neglected Irishman, John Field, little known now, but in his heyday, a legend, regarded as the greatest pianist of his time. When people heard Chopin play, they assumed Field must have taught him. I'll also be trying to unravel the mystery of who invented the nocturne. John Field and Frédéric Chopin as Composers of the Week, weekdays at 12 noon and 6:30.
And now on BBC Radio 3, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Making your way in the film business is notoriously difficult for a young director, so to have four big films under your belt by the age of 40 and to be already embarked on another is no small achievement. If I mention Pride and Prejudice, Atonement, The Soloist and Hannah, movie buffs amongst you will doubtless already have identified that Joe Wright is my guest. In fact, it's a Russian epic that you're engrossed in now, Joe.
It is, yeah. We're doing a adaptation of Anna Karenina, scripted by Sir Tom Stoppard, and I'm doing that with working title, and it's been a very challenging and exciting project.
And you've assembled a lot of the team you've worked with before.
Mm. I generally always work with the same team, both in front of and certainly behind the camera. My designer I've known for 15 years, my DOP for 20, my editor for a similar amount of time. I kind of like a little sort of family atmosphere, really. I find I feel safe and therefore relaxed and therefore creative. So that's very important to me. And then the actors as well. I like to keep working with the same actors and almost like a repertory company. And in particular, working with British and European actors as well is quite exciting.
Your obsession with filmmaking goes back quite a long way, doesn't it? You made Super 8 movies for yourself when you were young.
It goes back before I had a camera, in fact, because I think I saw a film when I was about 5. I saw Bambi, and it terrified the life out of me. And so I thought I needed to understand this thing. So I went home to my mum and said, "How do you make films?" And she got a long strip of cartridge paper that she happened to have lying around, and rather like a toilet roll of cartridge paper, and she's divided it into little boxes, squares, and we drew a succession of pictures depicting the tale of St. George and the dragon. And then she got a shoebox and cut a hole in the lid of the shoebox and put the paper on two gardening sticks and wound the strip of paper through this aperture in the shoebox and said, "That's how you make films."
It sounds as though there was quite a strong cultural influence then in your childhood, if you're
very much
that
so.
Imagination.
Yeah, no. My parents ran a puppet theatre in Islington called the Little Angel Theatre. They bought the site in 1959 and it opened its doors in 1961, and it's still running.
So creating drama was part of your life from an early age.
Yeah, I watched how stories were told and how pictures were made. There was a booking book by the dinner table in the house, and any time of day or night, 365 days of the year, the phone would ring and one of us would have to answer by saying, "Hello, Little Angel Theatre." And generally we'd, you know, take a booking. And so Bums on Seats was also something I grew up with as well.
And I think that the first music, in fact, takes you back.
Absolutely. The first piece is the opening music from my father's production of The Little Mermaid. I think that was really one of my father's great talents, was using music dramatically. And so, yeah, this is that.
And Janáček is an incredibly dramatic composer. I mean,
of course.
Raw emotion.
Yeah. I mean, he was really one of my dad's favourite composers, and I think he used him 2 or 3 times in various shows.
So this sound takes you back.
Very much so. In fact, I'll be quite surprised when I don't hear the narrator's voice come in and say, "This is a story about a little mermaid," but no ordinary mermaid, and the show began. The curtain would be down, my father would have come on stage and made quite a scary speech to all the kids, slightly frightened them, telling them that they had to be quiet during the show, and then the lights would dim and the music would start and the curtain would rise and there would be a gauze, and through the gauze you could just make out the figure of this beautiful, beautiful marionette that my father had carved, the mermaid, and the lighting would change and she'd be revealed there singing the melody of this piece to the figurehead of a ship that was sunk in a shipwreck. So that gives you the scene.
Thank you.
The third movement from the Janáček Sinfonietta, Opus 60, we heard the Philharmonia Orchestra conducted by Simon Rattle. The wonderful sort of pregnant, thick brass chords, almost ominous, and then the very lyrical string writing. And I could see you beginning to associate every moment with those visual images that you still have.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he'd edited the music. It was used throughout the production. And I remember him working on an old Revox quarter-inch tape machine with a splicer, splicing the tapes together late into the night. And I was always fascinated by that process. And so I think the lyrical violins for him were about the mermaid, and then the big brassy stuff was about the power of the ocean. And I could remember completely the exact moment where the prince starts to drown and where the fishes swim through, where the pipes come through. And I saw that show thousands and thousands and thousands of times, and we would tour all over the world with it, and it's part of my skin, really.
Now, I know that you use, perhaps rather unusually, Joe, right, music when you're filming, don't you? You actually like to play music.
I do. A lot of the music in my films is recorded prior to shooting. I'll talk to the composer and we kind of think of themes and a kind of melody for a specific character, or and then we'll have a temp version of that piece, and I'll play it on set.
Do you, I mean, while we're shooting. From my experience of having done film music, a director will say to you, well, of course, I thought of something slightly Wagnerian there, or I took something. Do you use that terminology with a composer?
Not really. To be honest, my classical education is not so great. I have a very broad appreciation of music, but is not so specific as to be able to say I want something Wagnerian. So I'll talk with Dario and we'll listen to different pieces. And I'll have a set. I mean, you know, I know who certain composers are. It's not. But I'll really talk in feeling.
Well, that's probably more liberating for him.
Yeah.
Than
yeah.
to be tied to a.
I don't really ever want a kind of pastiche of any other composer. You know, I want the composer I'm working with. I want their soul.
To be creative in their own right.
Yeah, exactly.
Dario Marianelli, of course, you were talking about, and we'll hear his music later. But I think you did use this next piece when you were working on Anna Karenina, when you were shooting it.
I did, yeah. I mean, also, I play music that the composer has written specifically for the film, but also I'm a bit of an iPod freak, and I play music pretty much constantly. Sometimes it's to lift the energy of the crew, and I'll put on some progressive house from the 1990s. And sometimes it's to get the actors into the right kind of mood. And so I'll play something like this Max Richter piece. This piece was introduced to me fairly recently by the choreographer Sidi Labi Shakawi, who came and choreographed a lot of Anna Karenina. There's a lot of dance in it, not just in the ballroom scenes, but actually within the dramatic scenes themselves. And he introduced me to this piece, and I kind of fell in love with it, really.
Well, actually, funny enough, I've come across his music in dance performance more than anywhere else.
Yeah. He also did the score for a wonderful film called Waltz with Bashir as well. So, he's a new discovery. A lot of the music here is stuff that I've known for and loved for a long time, so I thought I'd put this one in because it's a new discovery for me.
Thank you.
Max Richter and On the Nature of Daylight. There's something quite minimalist and meditative about that music, I think. So it's rather fascinating, Joe Wright, that we're going to hear next one of the great sort of minimalist composers of recent years, Philip Glass, but in a marriage with a composer and artist who has completely mastered the idea of mantra.
Mm-hmm. Well, really, I mean, outside of work, I kind of use music for two things, and there's two categories of music I have and listen to. One is dance music, which I play in the mornings generally, and the other is something more meditative and something that can help me feel, actually, if I'm having trouble feeling something that I need to. And so I think that Max Richter piece certainly has that effect. And the next piece also has a more vigorous rhythm, but also it has a feeling of aspiration. It makes me want to aspire to something more beautiful and perfect and holy. And I love the combination of these two great men.
We have said that Ravi Shankar is working here with Philip Glass. And the interesting thing is that Indian music and raga is incredibly complex, actually. Mm. And very often what Philip Glass does, although it has rhythmic changes in it that can be complex, it's often about simplicity.
Absolutely. I first started listening to Glass's work when I was 21 years old or something, when I was at art school, and I used to play Einstein on the beach whilst walking around the Tate on drugs, and which I don't advise the drugs, but you know, I can advise the music and the art. And the simplicity is something that helps me think. That's not to downplay the importance of the music or the significance of the music or the intelligence of the music. Simplicity is something that I think is far harder to achieve in life and in art than complexity, to be honest with you.
And you must have now considerable insight into the art of Ravi Shankar, because, of course, he's your father-in-law. So you've come across the music firsthand.
Yeah.
And, of course, Anushka, his daughter, your wife, is a great exponent.
Absolutely. Well, I could never quite understand where Philip Glass came from, these sounds, these strange kind of harmonies and rhythms, and I thought that it would all come from nowhere, really. And it was after meeting Pandit Ravi Shankar, my father-in-law, and learning about a little bit about Indian music, Indian classical music, that I discovered actually what he was doing was borrowing a lot of the themes and ideas from ragas. And I find it incredibly inspiring. I mean, Ravaji is an amazingly inspiring man and his dedication to his craft. And, you know, I was talking to him the other day and I said to him, he's 91, and I said to him, how many ragas do you know, Baba? And he said, well, let me think about it. Probably that I have a proper grasp on, about 4,000. I just find extraordinary. And he's someone who has music playing in his head, if not from his hands, from the moment he wakes up to the moment he goes to sleep. And in fact, I've seen him sleeping with his fingers still playing. And I think the respect with which he pays his music and his talent, I think, is something that's really been lost from Western arts a lot. Because to him it is a spiritual expression. You know.
The extraordinary thing is that that influence passed to Glass as a very young man from Ravi Shankar, because he was working with him, notating music, before he was really as well known as he is now. So it's rather wonderful we now have this collaboration, meetings along the edge. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Philip Glass.
We heard Ravi Shankar and Philip Glass in Meetings Along the Edge, part of their collaboration Passages. We also heard the Madras Choir Orchestral Group.
Listening to that piece of music, I can't help but think about the extraordinary influence Ravages had on my life over quite a short period of time, but without ever saying much. He's quite a quiet man, really.
Well, one of the people that he worked with and influenced him to a certain degree was Yehudi Menuhin, who has a very similar presence. It's very quiet, but had a kind of slightly, I suppose you'd call it an aura.
Yeah, it's an embarrassing word, aura, because it makes me think of ladies dressed in purple wearing amethyst. But it's true, he does have a kind of aura. And, you know, when you meet him, he's a guru, right? And so you think that that's just a kind of term or a label, like a knighthood or something. But as you get to know him, you realise that there's a very strong reason for him being called a guru. And yet he never sits down and teaches you anything, unless you're a sitar player or a musician. You know, he never... It's just in his presence, as you say.
Well, of course, the Beatles, in that very formative period, just wanted to be where he was, didn't they? And sit listening and...
Especially George.
George Harrison.
And, who, I think also George had a profound influence on Ravi as well. I mean, I think, and the things they did together, I mean, the concert for Bangladesh, and, you know, that was the first charity concert, I believe. And the influence he's had, not just on individuals, but globally. And yet he's never jammed with any of these people. I was talking to him the other day and he said, I've never jammed with the Beatles. I didn't jam with John Coltrane or Jimi Hendrix. He only ever played classical Indian music. And the only thing that would come close to what he would term as jamming were the records he made with Yehudi Menuhin. And that's an extraordinary thing, not to be tempted into the kind of glory of it, you know.
Well, that's the integrity of the musical purpose, because actually indie music is very strict. I mean,
incredibly.
You don't take liberties in that way.
You know, and if it's a morning ragga, it should be played in the morning. And so you should never start a concert in the evening with a morning ragga. Possibly you could play a morning ragga at the very end of a concert if the concert has gone for 5 or 6 hours and the sun is beginning to rise. Then you can play a morning ragga. And what I found fascinating, and I find it in my own work too, is the way in which limitations create boundless opportunities creatively. And so within these very strict limitations, his music is infinite. And I find that a great inspiration.
Well, you've inadvertently taken us seamlessly to the next music, because you came to this really through precisely one of those situations in life. It's the soloist, of course, I'm thinking of, and the extraordinary story of that cellist.
So Nathaniel Ayres was a Juilliard-trained cellist, and he, I think in his third year, had what doctors would describe as a schizophrenic breakdown, and then proceeded to live on the streets for 30 years until a journalist from the Los Angeles Times called Steve Lopez found him playing under a statue of Beethoven in downtown Los Angeles, and there started a friendship, and a quite a complicated friendship, but one that was transforming for both men. Nathaniel was kind of obsessed with Beethoven, and he could play, you know, a lot of other composers' work, but Beethoven was his great hero, you know. So I discussed with Dario the idea that we'd only use Beethoven in the movie. I knew Beethoven's work a bit, but I wasn't by any means an aficionado, nor am I now. But I used the film as an opportunity to learn something. All my films, I try and find something that I'm going to learn from them. And so it was really an opportunity to be surrounded by Beethoven for some time.
Thank you.
the second profoundly lyrical movement from the Triple Concerto for Violin, Cello and Piano in C major, Opus 56, by Beethoven. We heard Joanne Pierce-Martin playing the piano, Martin Chalifour, the violin, and Ben Hong, the cello, with the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen. In a way, Joe Wright, I'm not surprised that that music would speak to you as strongly as it does, because one of the things that you're famous for, really, is long tracking shots. Mm. And in that music, Beethoven has wonderfully long lyrical lines. It reminds me of that wonderful Paul Klee saying, taking a line for a walk.
Yes. Funnily enough, it was used for a long tracking shot. And one of the things I decided when I accepted the job to make The Soloist was that I would employ 500 members of the downtown homeless community, 80% of whom suffer from some form of mental illness. It's the biggest concentration of homelessness in America and is a very, very shocking place. And so we worked with these 500 people who worked as extras and as actors and also as crew. And the music we played on set was often a piece like the Triple Concerto. And the whole street, you know, would just take on this sublime, almost beatific kind of smile. And it was a very, very moving experience. It was, I think, probably my favourite thing about making that film was working with those people. And
it is extraordinary how, you know, people always say classical music elitist, you know, but actually, when a great piece of music is played to a large number of people, it really completely transcends any kind of label.
I don't think it's elitist. I think it's fairly impenetrable, really. I think that's the problem, you know, that there's so much of it and it's got all these funny words and names and a completely different language and is incredibly daunting. It's much easier to remember a name like the Chemical Brothers than it is to remember some of the names in classical music. Janacek, for instance.
We mentioned earlier, Joe Wright, Dario Marinelli, who you have worked with a lot on your films, and I think the music you've chosen is from Atonement, the Ian McEwan novel that you filmed with great success with Keira Knightley and James McAvoy. And that had a huge tracking shot, didn't it?
Absolutely. And this is the piece of music that was from that tracking shot. It was, I think, one of the most extraordinary days of my life, certainly one of the most extraordinary creative and professional days of my life, when we made the tracking shot on the beach at Redcar. And I can't help but get kind of dewy-eyed whenever I hear this piece of music. And it was something about the people who came and made the film with us. We employed 1,000 members of the local community from Redcar, a lot of the steel workers and a lot of the unemployed, a lot of unemployment up there.
Redcar posing as Dunkirk.
Redcar posing as Dunkirk, exactly. And we asked them to come and be in our film, and they came and built the set with us, and it turned into a kind of community event. The community became really excited about it, and it became this thing where kids would be brought down in their prams to see the set being built, and there were Sunday kind of outings, picnics, and I think I possibly was very naive in doing it, because, you know, I allowed myself really a 45-minute window to shoot it. We rehearsed all day.
You can't retake that thing that many times.
No. We got 3 takes, and the 3rd take happened to have life.
Just explain for people that don't know what we mean by a tracking shot.
It's not a tracking shot. It's a Steadicam shot.
But so, it's one long shot.
Yes, it's really one. It's one very long shot. The camera operator, Pete Robson, was carrying a camera with a kind of balancing device, which I think weighs somewhere in the region of 300 pounds. You know, I mean, it's an incredibly heavy piece of kit. And so he started on a kind of rickshaw thing, and then climbed off the rickshaw and climbed across the sand, and then up a wall, and then went round a bandstand where the Redcar choir was singing, or the Dunkirk choir was singing, and then pulled back, stepped onto another rickshaw, got pulled back through all this army hardware, horses riding through and kind of big wheels going, and in the background the steel foundry, and then finally kind of went across to a view of the beach and the men on the beach. So it was an amazing feat, really, by Pete.
One of the things I find very encouraging about that is, you know, as a filmmaker, you know better than I, especially with television now, we're always being made to sort of look at, you know, 12 seconds is too long to hold the attention, so we've got to change the shot every few seconds. Mm. And you know, we don't dare see a talking head for more than half a minute. And so to actually reassert the primacy of something that is long and slow and holds its attention by the beauty of the conception, as opposed to having endless images.
Although there
flashed.
Was a lot going on in the shot.
Well, of course.
Do you know what I mean?
True.
I mean, it's like, you know, there was a lot of excitement within the very long take. But I agree with you. I become quite tired of extreme fast editing because I think it was an exciting style, but it's kind of been done to death now. Mm. And so I enjoy the idea of looking at other forms, really.
Well, this is Dario's Elegy, which was the soundtrack to it, of course. is the friction that's created by the collision of those two sound worlds, isn't it, which is particularly moving when you hear the choir singing and the music carries on sliding against it, really.
The orchestra seems to be a comment on the choir, really. Although the choir are pretty moving by themselves as well, I must say, when we were filming it. They were, everyone really gave of themselves that day. And I just found it very moving to see that many men really, who are all kind of tough and hard and, you know, actually engage in a way with all their hearts. And it was very special. I've got to say, Michael, I haven't actually sat in someone's bedroom and listened to a load of records, I don't think, since I was a teenager. It just reminded me sitting with my mate Mark Monero, listening to Soft Machine and going, wow.
Life is full of surprises. Yeah. That was Dario Marinelli's Elegy for Dunkirk from Atonement. And we heard the English Chamber Orchestra, directed by Benjamin Wallfisch, with Caroline Dale playing the cello. It's a thin line, isn't it, I guess, for music in films where it needs to underscore but not take over.
Although very, very rarely do I actually use music in dialogue scenes. Kind of never, really. I mean, I kind of have always believed, because of, I think, my respect for music and my love of music, that if there's music, then it's a music moment, and if it's dialogue, then it's a dialogue moment, and I don't like music under dialogue. It feels cheap, really, to me. So therefore, when Dario, you know, or the Chemical Brothers or whoever, when they have a music moment, they can really...
Let rip.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, a few months ago, Joe, we had a delightful programme with your wife, Anushka Shankar, and I guess you couldn't come here and not include her in your choice of music.
Of course not, but then I wouldn't want to. I mean, it's a lovely irony that I've ended up marrying a musician and such an extraordinary one as Anushka, and I feel very lucky, really, because music has become even more part of my life and will be a part of my son's life. You know, we have a son now, and I think probably about his third or fourth word was tabla. And he has a small tabla and he slams away at it. And no, music is vital. Without music or laughter, I'm not sure how we'd really get through, you know.
So what have you chosen?
I've chosen a piece from her latest album called Bulleria con Ricardo. So it's a piece she recorded with a pianist called Pedro Ricardo Mino in Spain. He's a flamenco pianist. I think maybe one of the only ones.
Yeah, because it's not an instrument one associates immediately.
No, but it works so well. It really does. It's a really lovely meeting, you know, because it's so percussive and so kind of strong as well. Such a strong heart to it.
Music from Buleria con Ricardo, from Anushka Shankar's album Traveller. We started with your childhood memories, and I think we're going to end with one, actually.
Yeah, we started with the Little Mermaid, my father's puppet show, and the puppet theatre where I grew up was a very warm place, and there were a lot of parties. On Saturday night, there'd generally be a feast, and my dad would cook a big curry, and people would come and get very drunk, and no doubt at a certain point in the evening, this record would be put on the turntable, and the adults would all start dancing. And I can't listen to this song without thinking of my father died in 91, so I think of him, and I think of my mum, and them dancing together, and them both with slightly rosy cheeks from too much cheap wine, and looking so blissfully happy, and me and my sister kind of dancing around them. And I guess my love of dance and music does really come from my earliest childhood memories. So this is one of them.
La 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 la. La la li la 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 li la 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 li la 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 li la. When shadows fall and stars appear, the pain I feel I cannot bear. If I could relive that fateful day, I would not turn my love away. I'd reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. I'd reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. When I think of her tender lips, gentle touch of her fingertips, reminisce on her eyes so fair, moonlight soft on her downy hair. I'd reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. I'd reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. If someday I should see her smile, hold her hand and me heart beguile, feel her warmth, hear her earnest prayer, darling, shield me from all despair. I'd reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. I'd reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. Now I'm standing alone and sad, thinking up on the joys I've had. Time makes fools of man, they say, take me back to that distant day. I'd reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her. I'd reveal how I do adore her, hang my heart on my sleeve just for her, all my love throughout life assure her, if this moment I could amour her.
Harry Belafonte and I Do Adore Her. Well, thank you very much, Joe Wright, for taking us on this musical excursion through your childhood and through your filmmaking, indeed. We've got Anna Karenina coming up, and I dare say you've got another ball rolling.
Yeah, couple. I don't really know what I'm going to do next. I need to try and stop working so much, really. I'm a bit psychologically dependent on work, and I need to possibly address that and spend a bit more time with my son.
Joe Wright, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Wright was talking to Michael Barclay, and his latest film, Anna Karenina, has just gone on general release. Next week on Private Passions, there's another chance to hear a programme recorded last year with the stage director, Michael Grandage. That's at the same time, midday, next Sunday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
A is for action.
How a piano feels to you, makes a performance.
B is for boogie-woogie.
It's stimulating the mind into a form of excitement where you almost lose your senses. And for those few moments, the chaos of the universe will come into order.
C is for competition.
If you go in with the idea that you may not get anywhere, you may not win, but you have to focus on the chance that you might and prepare for it, it's a really good discipline.
Piano season of the BBC continues with an A to Z of the piano daily on In Tune. Weekdays, 4:30 to 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. It's 1 o'clock, time now for the news read by David Cornett.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has announced plans for parents and grandparents to use their pensions to help younger family members get onto the property ladder. Under the scheme, pensions will be used to guarantee loans for house deposits. The Liberal Democrat leader, who's facing poor opinion poll ratings, is trying to rally his party at their annual conference in Brighton. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, says that increasing the number of tax inspectors checking the accounts of the most wealthy has already brought in an extra £44 million. Dozens of inspectors are being hired to bolster the Affluence Unit, which will now investigate the affairs of people with assets worth more than £1 million, if they believe there might be a case. Previously, the unit has looked only at those worth at least £2.5 million. The Libyan authorities have ordered illegal armed groups and militias to disband. One group, accused of killing the US ambassador to Libya in Benghazi, has been driven out by residents. Concern inside and outside Libya has been growing because of the continuing power of the many militias that emerged in last year's revolution, which toppled Colonel Gaddafi. An investigation is to be held into a mid-air collision between two skydivers, in which one man was killed. The other man was seriously injured. The accident happened near Peterborough yesterday afternoon. Church services are being held in Manchester to remember PC Nicola Hughes and PC Fiona Bone, who were killed in a gun and grenade attack in the city last week. During a service this morning in Hattersley, the Bishop of Shrewsbury spoke of the shock and horror of Tuesday's events. There'll also be a service of reflection this afternoon in Mottram, near to where the officers were attacked. And the weather, a wet and windy day, spreading up the country from the south, reaching into much of Wales, central England and East Anglia by this afternoon. The rain will be very heavy in places and there's a chance of gale force winds in the south. But it will be drier with some sunshine in the north. BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
And it was read by David Cornett. Time now on Radio 3 for the Early Music Show.
Hello, I'm Lucy Skeeping, and it's a particularly good one today for any Telemann nuts out there. We're hearing highlights from a concert given at St John Smith Square, part of the Lufthansa Festival of Baroque Music. The performers are Ensemble Meridiana, a five-piece group who represent four different countries between them: England, Germany, Sweden, Norway and Switzerland, where they all met while studying at the famous Schola Cantorum in Basel. And for this reason alone, Telemann suits them perfectly, for here is a composer whose music represents a true mix of international styles. Our first piece dates from around 1730. It's one of Telemann's so-called quartets, but in fact there are three solo instruments here, the recorder, oboe and violin, plus a continuo. And the result is a sort of hybrid between a sonata and a concerto. There's some lovely dance-like melodies from the recorder and oboe in the first movement, while the violin does its own virtuoso thing around them. The second features the sort of dotted rhythms associated with the French style. And for the final movement, well, there's all the sharp colour and cheek, as Matheson put it, of the Italian style. Ensemble Meridiana with Telemann's Quartet Concerto in G.